Hello, everyone, and welcome to the American Immigration Lawyers Association's podcast entitled I-864 Affidavits of Support, Avoiding Ethical Pitfalls. I'm J.J. Area, AILA's Education Associate, and it is my pleasure to introduce today's panel. The discussion leader for this podcast is Alan Goldfarb, the AILA Ethics Committee Chair from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Joining Alan are Greg McLawson from Tacoma, Washington, and Annie Wong from New York, New York. The speakers have carefully selected written materials for this podcast, which can be found in your AILA Agora digital library. Go to agora.aila.org and make sure you're signed in. On the top right of the page, you'll see a green button that says My Digital Library. Once on the page for your digital library, you'll see two files. One is the audio file, and right above or below, a resources file. If you have any questions, you can email agora@aila.org. At this time, I'd like to turn the podcast over to Alan.
Thank you, JJ. So the topic for today is affidavits of support, and we're going to focus on ethical issues related to these affidavits of support, which are a common feature of immigration practice. And ethics are really a focus for all of us who are working in immigration cases where we're routinely representing a petitioner and a beneficiary. We, in immigration practice, focus on a lot of cases where dual representation is just a common feature of what we do. There are special challenges with affidavits of support, and the purpose of this podcast is to focus on some of those ethical challenges and to try to identify potential conflicts and ways to avoid conflicts of interest, and at the same time providing representation to clients that would be ethical and consistent with the ethics rules. And during the course of the podcast, if we cite to the model rules, we want to emphasize also that it's really important to check the particular state version of the rules in place in your jurisdiction, because those state rules they can vary, even though they may be based on the model rules. I'll start by just providing some basic overview on the affidavit of support requirement. We'll also talk a little bit more about what makes the affidavit of support effective, what's required for the affidavit of support, and then how long the obligation lasts. We'll continue by explaining some of the risks of sponsorship, identifying conflicts of interest in preparing an affidavit of support, and then ways to avoid conflicts within with the different parties involved in preparing affidavits of support. So just as a kind of basic overview, which most people would already know, the affidavit of support is a requirement for family-based applicants to satisfy the public charge ground of inadmissibility, which applies to people coming in to the United States either through immigrant visas or applying for adjustment of status to permanent residence within the U.S. And the principal, the petitioner on the application has to file the affidavit of support and to meet certain income requirements. It is possible to get a joint sponsor or a household member to join to file separate affidavits of support, or to join in the affidavit of support if you're a household member. The requirement of an affidavit of support also applies to certain employment-based applicants if the relative of the petition owns a certain percentage of the business, and it's defined as at least 5% ownership in the business. And there are certain cases where people are applying for permanent residence where they don't have to meet the affidavit support requirements. There isn't the public charge ground of inadmissibility doesn't apply, and those would be examples would be people applying for adjustment after entering based on asylum or in refugee status, people who qualify for registry. There are probably fewer of those people nowadays than earlier, or if you're applying for adjustment based on cancellation of removal, for example. But it is a general requirement, and we want to focus on what you need to do to qualify to meet the affidavit of support to file the affidavit of support to overcome the public charge ground of inadmissibility. And Andy, I wonder if you want to just go through to talk about the requirements for an affidavit of support to set the stage for the ethical discussion.
Sure, Alan. So generally, affidavits of support have to meet five requirements. The first is that the petitioner, or we would refer to them also as the sponsor for affidavit purposes, is required to file a Form I-864, which is the form number. Number two, the sponsor must be a U.S. citizen or a lawful permanent resident, must be at least 18 years old, and must be domiciled in the U.S. The third requirement is that the affidavit is legally enforceable against the sponsor in any actions that are brought by the sponsored immigrant or by the government, including state, to recover the benefits that were paid to the sponsored individual. Four, the affidavit of support must meet strict income requirements, which require that sponsors demonstrate the means to maintain an annual income of at least 125% of the federal poverty guidelines. And I just want to refer listeners to the Health and Human Services Poverty Guidelines for Affidavit of Support. That's available on the form, USCIS form I-864-P, as in poverty. Thus far, I haven't seen yet the new 2017 poverty guidelines, but under the 2016 guidelines for a household size of two, which would include the sponsor, the 125% of HHS poverty guidelines comes out to $20,000 and 25. $20,000 and 25. So that is generally the case for Alaska and Hawaii. You have different guidelines. So finally, the sponsor agrees through filing this I-864 to provide support to maintain the sponsored immigrant at an annual income, as I said, of not less than 125% of the federal poverty guidelines, must reimburse any federal or state agency that provides a means-tested benefit to the sponsored immigrant, which I think we'll talk about a little later, must agree to submit to the jurisdiction of a federal or state court for enforcement purposes, and also is obligated to inform the Department of Homeland Security of any changes of address.
And Annie, how long does this obligation last? So if you're filing an affidavit of support, is it just when the application is approved, or how long is that obligation to provide the support or to submit to these requirements? How long does that continue?
A lot longer than people realize when they take on this obligation. So the liability of the petitioner and sponsor terminates under these circumstances: when the sponsored immigrant naturalizes, when he or she earns 40 qualifying quarters of employment under the Social Security Act, which usually equates to working for 10 years, and that sponsored individual can be credited with those 40 qualifying quarters based on the employment of the sponsor. Also, when the immigrant dies, that liability terminates, as well as when the sponsored immigrant loses or abandons their permanent resident status and leaves the United States, or in the last circumstance, when the sponsor passes away. And just to be clear, the liability of the sponsor does not terminate upon divorce.
That's a really interesting point,
yeah.
Because a lot of these are, you know, a lot of the clients are marriage-based cases. And,
exactly.
And so that just continues after the marriage ends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is also possible to have your liability terminated as the sponsor through filing for bankruptcy, as all debts, unless they're exempt by the federal statute, are dischargeable in bankruptcy. So you can see that the liability is pretty heavy. Sure.
Yeah, so just to comment on Annie's point, this is Greg McLaughlin. The only federal courts to consider it, and there have been only two, have both held that the sponsor's obligation under the I-864 is a non-dischargeable domestic support obligation. So even if the sponsor were to go into bankruptcy proceedings, there's a very good argument, I think it's the correct proposition, mm-hmm. that the debt follows him forever.
So it wouldn't be dischargeable in bankruptcy.
Yeah.
So it's
so that's
yeah,
our,
not dischargeable.
Yeah. So that's an example of where case law has changed what the liability might have been. So you can see that the liability is a very attenuated in terms of time frame. So really, it's something that a sponsor has to carefully consider when they agree to sign the affidavit.
Thanks, Annie. So it's important to know that the obligation could continue for a pretty long duration. We're usually involved in the case when we're trying to help the sponsored employee get permanent residence. Sponsored applicant get permanent residence. So, Greg, how do you explain to the client what they're getting into, that you know the sponsor, whether it's the petitioner or someone else, how do you go through and explain the risks of sponsorship so that someone really has a clear understanding of what they're getting into?
Thanks, Ellen. So this is Greg McLaughlin here. And just by way of a little background, I have a slightly different take on this than perhaps some other immigration attorneys, because one of the things that I do is represent beneficiaries in lawsuits against their I-864 sponsors. When I talk to immigration attorneys about the I-864, I understand that people will say that this is an enforceable contract. You can get immigration attorneys to acknowledge that it is an enforceable contract. But I want you to feel that in your bones, because you need to understand that it's not just theoretically enforceable, but in fact, there have been over 100 reported cases nationwide. The scope of liability is very high. Large judgments have been entered. And when you're talking to your client about this, you need to be motivated not just by some dry understanding of what the law might be, but a real appreciation of the fact that your sponsor could very well end up on the receiving end of a lawsuit down the line. So let's take a little bit of a look at what that looks like on a more granular level. So remember, as Annie was explaining, that there are two different promises that the I-64 sponsor makes. First of all, he promises, and it is usually a he who gets sued. In the vast majority of cases, it's a male sponsor, so that's the pronoun I'll use. He promises to repay the government for means-tested public benefits that are paid to the beneficiary, and also to maintain the beneficiary's income at, let's say it's about $15,000 a year for household size of one. To touch on the first of those two promises, until last week, it was a relatively rare occurrence for federal, state, or local agencies to go after sponsors to recoup means-tested public benefits. We now have I won't use the trigger word, the name of our new president, but we have an executive order sitting around right now that will mandate that federal agencies enforce the affidavit of support against sponsors if beneficiaries receive means-tested public benefits. And that executive order vastly expands the definition of programs that are covered under that. So if this draft order goes into effect, you could have the federal government on potentially a pretty large scale going after sponsors for means-tested public benefits. I want to focus, though, on the second of those two obligations, which is the income support requirement. So the foreign national beneficiary is not a party to the contract, right? She doesn't sign off on the affidavit of support. But it's very, very well established in case law that the I-864 is a contract between who? The sponsor who signs off and the federal government. And what does that make the beneficiary? That makes the immigrant beneficiary a third party beneficiary to the contract. And this might take folks back to days of yore in law school, but remember that third party beneficiaries can sue contracts that are signed for their benefits. And that's the case with the I-864. It's very well established that the immigrant beneficiary has standing to sue the sponsor in court. Now, as Annie touched on, recall that, of course, there may be joint sponsors in the case. And it's equally well established that a joint sponsor has joint and several liability with the I-864 principal sponsor. So it's up to the I-864 beneficiary whom she chooses to go after. Could be one, both, or one or the other of a joint and or joint sponsor. What can the I-864 beneficiary recover? Damages in these cases are at least theoretically easy to calculate. She's entitled to get a judgment for 125% of the poverty guideline. So again, let's say roughly $15,000 a year for whatever the period of time was for which the sponsor wasn't providing support, minus any income that she was actually receiving. And we can argue about what does and doesn't qualify as income, but that's the rough characterization of how damages are calculated. On top of that, she can recover attorney fees. And just to give a sense of what that might look like, you know, the principal liability in these cases is relatively low. You know, $15,000 a year in most civil litigation doesn't qualify as a huge liability. But the entitlement to attorney fees is very clear. So regardless of the amount of principal at issue, she's going to be able to get reasonable attorney fees that were incurred in the course of getting the judgment. And that could easily rack up to 60 grand or so for a case that's resolved just at the summary judgment stage. And you might end up in a situation where the attorney fees easily dwarf the principal liability. So this is to say that all of a sudden, that judgment against the sponsor pushes up close to the $100,000 mark. So, you know, again, when we're thinking about what might this look like down the road, understand that we might be talking about a judgment that would seriously imperil the financial well-being, certainly of any of the people I typically work with, or myself. That's a big judgment. Jurisdiction. Where does this get fought out? Federal court? Yeah. There's a little bit of a dispute about whether federal question jurisdiction exists in these cases because at least two magistrate judges in Florida, though apparently nobody else, looks at these cases and says, well, this looks like a contract, and we don't do contracts in federal court. But most federal judges look at the statute underlying the affidavit of support and have no problem locating a federal cause of action in that statute. State court, remember that state courts have concurrent jurisdiction. So if we view this as a contract action, of course state courts have jurisdiction because state courts do contract litigation all the time. But even if it's a federal cause of action, remember that state courts have concurrent jurisdiction with federal courts unless the federal statute strips them of that jurisdiction, and there's no such clause in the I-864 statute. So basically, the I-864 beneficiary gets her choice of forum. State courts do differ, however, as to whether they will enforce the affidavit in the context of a marital dissolution. Dissolution statutes, alimony or maintenance statutes vary from state to state, and it's not always clear whether a family court judge could use maintenance as a vehicle to enforce the affidavit of support. In Washington State, for example, where I live, the answer is no. You need to bring a separate cause of action. Perhaps last main point I will make, again, with respect to joint sponsors, and we'll get into ethics surrounding joint sponsors later. Joint sponsors can and are sued under the affidavit of support. We recently settled a case against the joint sponsor for a pretty significant amount. And so when we're later talking about joint sponsor ethics, please do not be under the mistaken assumption that, joint sponsors never get sued, nobody ever comes after them for support. Don't treat it as a hypothetical, because joint sponsors do get pursued for support under the affidavit.
Greg, I had a question. What about household member sponsor?
Thank you. Yes, the I-864A. Mm-hmm. It is rare for household members to be sued for support. However, it is very clear by the way that the statute on the I-864A are drafted that they would hold liability on that contract. It hasn't been tested as much as the affidavit of support, but there are at least a couple cases nationwide where household members have been successfully sued.
Greg, this is Alan. So you mentioned that large judgments are possible and that you're involved in some of these cases and that $100,000 wouldn't be unusual. Are you also more concerned about government actions for reimbursement of benefits? Could that be significantly more than $100,000 in terms of the liability for the sponsor?
You know, the place where we could really imagine those judgments getting astronomical would be in the case of medical benefits. You know, if you had an individual on Medicaid who got into a terrible accident or just had costly treatment for a serious disease, gosh, you could get way, way, way past the $100,000 mark in a hurry with those. So, yeah, I mean, the scope of liability is actually probably significantly greater if the executive order actually gets implemented in the way that it's drafted now.
Oh, that's a really good overview. Also, a good introduction to the liability and then the importance of identifying who your client is and avoiding conflicts of interest if possible. So the next section of the discussion will be on identifying conflicts of interest. The rule that applies is the ABA Model Rule 1.7, and it's a relatively short rule, but there are also 35 comments to the rule for two paragraphs. So it's a rule that's very difficult to interpret, but we also, as immigration attorneys, are familiar with 1.7. And there are different considerations for identifying conflicts of interest. One would be, that there's a prohibition on representing a client if the representation involves a concurrent or a direct conflict with another client. So that's pretty clear. The other provision is if there's a significant risk that the representation of one or more clients will be materially limited by the lawyer's responsibility to another client, a former client, a third person, or a personal interest of the lawyer. And the last item on the personal interest of the lawyer is was the topic of a D.C. ethics opinion in 2010 that's part of the materials, where there was an advisory opinion issued for a lawyer who asked about whether an immigration lawyer, whether he could file an affidavit of support as a joint sponsor on behalf of a client, and the response was, yeah, it's certainly possible to do that, but you'd have to withdraw from representation, and it's probably not very likely that many lawyers would stay in business for long if they agreed to serve as joint sponsors for their clients who need affidavits of support. So I think in identifying conflicts of interest, there are different parties to the case, and Annie and Greg, you can jump in if you have any comments, but obviously the principal client would be the intending immigrant or the immigrant who's being sponsored. The petitioner would be another party to the case, and the person who would be required to file the affidavit of support. We talked about household members, so other members of the household who would be signing I-64A as a contract and including their income in calculating the requirement for the affidavit of support, and then also joint sponsors. So if the petitioner's income isn't sufficient, the petitioner would still file the affidavit of support, but there would also have to be a joint sponsor to be able for the intending immigrant to overcome the public charge ground of inadmissibility. So there are lots of different parties involved, and maybe others as well. And so the question is whether, first of all, we try to identify who is the client. If there's a potential or actual conflict, that's another way that we analyze conflicts of interest. And if there is a conflict, whether it's consentable, whether you can waive that conflict, and it is possible to go through to continue representation if the lawyer reasonably believes that he or she will be able to provide competent and diligent representation to each affected client. The representation isn't prohibited by law. It doesn't involve the assertion of one claim, of a claim by one client against another who's represented by the lawyer in the same proceeding before a tribunal. And then finally, each affected client has to give informed consent, which then has to be confirmed in writing. So in order to get a waiver, if there is a conflict, you have to go through a separate waiver process, and informed consent is a requirement, and it's difficult to do. I think we'd probably agree that in most cases, the first concern, whether there is a direct conflict, may not exist at the beginning of the case. So if you're representing an individual, a foreign national who's applying for permanent residence, most often, you know, everyone involved is going to want that person to become a permanent resident. Otherwise, you wouldn't have a case to proceed, and you wouldn't even be talking to a joint sponsor. But the risk of representation, that representation will be materially limited by the lawyer's responsibilities to another client, is something that we'll get into a little bit more in talking about a joint sponsor. But that's certainly something that we'd have to consider in deciding whether we can have a dual or we can represent multiple clients in the same case, because that's a more likely concern for the affidavit of support requirement. So the question is mostly whether there would be a future conflict later, and whether the attorney going forward would be materially limited in the type of assistance that the attorney could provide based on the representation of another client or another, or the attorney's own interest or something like that. So those are the considerations we take into account. And since there are different parties, it's not just representing the petitioner and the beneficiary, but also considering other parties like the joint sponsor. Then it just makes the calculation harder in deciding whether a concurrent representation is possible, and something that we really want to think about very closely when at the very outset of the case, so that we can avoid problems later on that are going to happen, especially knowing, based on what Annie discussed, that this obligation can continue for quite a long time. So it's not just something that is over when the client is approved for permanent residence and has the green card. It continues after that. So I'd like to move on now and ask Greg to discuss a little bit about how you explain your procedure and you provide information about I-864 liability at the outset of a case in a legal services contract.
Thanks, Alan. So, I mean, just to restate the inherent tension that Alan was just pointing out in these cases, you know, in most adjustment of status applications in family-based matters or immigrant visa petitions, you are representing, number one, the beneficiary, the intending immigrant, who has got to have that I-864 signed or she can't immigrate or adjust. You owe her unfettered duties of as her fiduciary, and at the same time, you also represent the sponsor, and you owe him unfettered duties of allegiance and serving as his fiduciary. And so as part of that, you've darn well got to tell him what he's signing when he executes that binding contract with the federal government that you have drafted for his signature. So at our firm, and I don't think this is unusual at all, but just to tell you what we include in our legal services agreement, there are basically three things. Number one, we outline in the legal services agreement what the sponsor's obligations are under the I-864. And by the way, all of this sample language will be linked to in the show notes. So JJ will be providing a link where you can download a Word copy of these sample terms. Number one, we tell the sponsor in hopefully clear and concise language what he's getting into when he signs the affidavit of support. But we can't get into the position of providing partisan advice to the I-864 sponsor, at this point the would-be sponsor, that would be against the interest of our other client, the intending immigrant. So we take the approach that we outline his obligations, and then we advise in our legal services agreement that if he wants further partisan advice about the affidavit of support, he's got to go speak to another independent attorney. And here's just one example of what that advice might be. There are people who have attempted to waive their obligations under the affidavit of support. You know, a lot of times, and this is typically how it is raised in enforcement contexts, this is a married couple. So if you are about to get married, or you're already married, and you're about to start the immigration process, well, why not sign a nuptial waiver of your affidavit of support liabilities? You know, normally under matrimonial law, you can waive pretty much darn well whatever you want to in a nuptial agreement, as long as you've got representation of counsel, et cetera, et cetera. So a number of folks have tested whether they could sign a contract that says, yeah, okay, I know that this affidavit of support was signed for my benefit, but I, as the beneficiary, elect to forego ever enforcing that obligation in exchange for some form of consideration. You know, insert whatever you would put in a normal marital nuptial contract. Now, the courts have disagreed about whether those are enforceable. The majority view is no, but that's a type of consideration that if you were providing partisan advice to the sponsor, you might want to consider. You might want to say, hey, sponsor, you might want to consider this waiver of, or insisting on a waiver of your support obligation. And gosh, do you really want to get into that conversation if you're also representing the beneficiary who's going through this process? I don't. So we refer that individual to third-party counsel. And then the last thing we include in the legal services agreement is our conflict procedure to say, if down the line we discover there's a conflict between the two of you and you no longer share the same legal objective, which is usually code words for if the marriage falls apart in the middle of this process, here's what's going to happen. And one of the things that's going to happen is we can't conceal information from, you know, one of you. So if one of you dishes on the other, that's going to get communicated to the other client, and we're going to be off the case. It's going to be over. And that's easy enough to put into a legal services agreement, and you could be in a very bad position if the clients arrived at that point of their relationship and didn't have clear expectations for how that was going to impact your representation. So again, sample language for your easy download. And if folks have improvements on it, I'm sure we would be interested in hearing about those.
And Greg, just to be clear too, sorry, Annie, that if you're representing a couple, married couple, this is information that it's pretty clear that if before the case is approved and the marriage doesn't work out, then it's over. But after the marriage, that's where maybe the extra advice is needed about the consequences that it continues. And if the obligation continues after divorce, then that requires special disclosures about what they're getting into.
Right. Yes. Certainly, explaining the duration of the obligation has got to be part of it.
So I recall that when we were preparing for this podcast, we were talking about the different approaches that each of us have taken in terms of the legal services agreement that we would be asking our clients or clients to sign after they've read all of the different components. And I know in the past that even though I have suggested to both parties or spouses that they can get separate counsel. Greg, I was just curious, based on your experience, do you ever represent both parties?
Yeah, so most of the work at our firm is pretty typical marriage-based right. adjustment and IV cases. And yeah, we do joint representation of I-130 petitioners and I-485 applicants all the time.
And how about you, Alan?
Yeah, I mean, it's the same. I think it's a harder calculation when there's a joint sponsor involved.
Yeah.
That's just it's a different approach. I think that there is a difference because, the petitioners, the idea is when you're pursuing this, you want to know what you're getting into, what the risks are, but the idea is that you're going to be married and staying together, and things happen during the course of the marriage, but it's important to think about what the consequences would be, especially with respect to the affidavit of support. But for a third party that is needed, if there's a joint sponsor that's needed, the attorney is providing information about. It really, if the attorney is representing the couple or the intending immigrant, if through family sponsorship, the goal is to get the application submitted with all the supporting documents, including the joint sponsor affidavit of support. And there's a real tension between telling the joint sponsor about the consequences that would most likely lead the joint sponsor to decide not to go ahead with the with signing the affidavit of support and submitting it, and being able to be able to file the application on behalf of the intending immigrant, and that I think that's where the real challenge comes in.
Is that our segue into joint sponsor ethics?
Let's just move on to that. I mean we wanted to talk a little bit about working with a joint sponsor and also about the changes to the I-64 form that took effect in 2015 and how that impacts your representation of joint sponsors. And Greg, I think you were going to talk a little bit more about your position in representing joint sponsors. And Annie, you should feel free to join in as well.
Yeah, so, and Annie, definitely just jump in, especially if you have a dissenting view. So the background to this is that, you know, recall it, you don't necessarily have an attorney-client relationship with somebody just because you draft a document for their signature. So, for example, you know, if you're in litigation and you draft a declaration for some witness, you don't become that person's attorney merely because you drafted it for their signature. And so in days of yore, it was possible to be an immigration attorney and have the not totally unreasonable understanding that you don't necessarily become a joint sponsor's attorney just because you draft the I-864 for them. So you could paper over your relationship with that person, you know, with a big lawyerly cover letter and say, "Dear person, I've drafted this document at my client's instruction, but I am not your attorney. I'm not providing you independent advice about what you're getting into. Not your attorney, not your attorney. Go talk to somebody else if you want to understand what you're signing." And that was not a totally ridiculous thing to think until July 2015. What happened then? As it is wont to do, basically every year, USCIS started monkeying around with the language in the form, and they added the following language. They added a statement that, quote, "I, the attorney signing the form, I am an attorney, and my representation of the sponsor in this case either does or doesn't extend beyond preparation of this affidavit. The attorney must also certify penalty of perjury, that she represents the sponsor, at least for purposes of signing the form." So it is now no longer possible to draft an I-864 for a joint sponsor without making that certification in writing that you've signed that you are representing the sponsor. Well, so what? Well, there aren't different flavors of attorney-client relationships, meaning that there is no such thing as a principal client and a sort of client and a, you know, 8 points out of 10 points client. Once you've established an attorney-client relationship with somebody, you owe them the full slate of ethical duties that come along with an attorney-client relationship.
So, Greg, in that choice, if you mark that your representation doesn't extend beyond the preparation of this affidavit of support, you think that that doesn't make that much of a difference in terms of your representation of the client?
Well, you've certified that you're representing them, and you've certified that at the very least the scope of your representation includes preparation of that form. So my view is that if you are preparing that document for somebody as their attorney, I think that has to carry with it the scope of responsibility to explain to the person what it is that they're signing. To me, that seems very clear, that if I went to a lawyer and said, "Hey, lawyer, who is my lawyer and I am your client, thank you for signing me this, thank you for preparing this document for me," I would darn well expect that attorney to explain to me what it was that he had prepared for my signature.
And I would agree with you on that completely.
And so I think that's where it becomes tricky, because my view is that once you accept that you have a responsibility to tell the person what it is that you've prepared for them, well, what does that advice look like? In my view, it's not good enough to just say, you know, dryly, "Oh, sponsor, this is a financial contract, and it's theoretically possible you might get sued for it." If you're that person's attorney, you need to get them to wake up and understand in a real sense that they might get sued for a lot of money. And the obligation goes on for a long time. And you kind of need to shake the person a little bit and say, no, you don't understand. Like, this is a real substantial obligation that you're getting yourself into. And to my mind, I would not want to be, and I don't want to be, in the position of, on the one hand, having to shake that person by the lapels and basically, in a sense, try to get them not to sign that contract because they're signing over a lot of financial liability and getting absolutely nothing in return. And on the other hand, trying to adhere to my fiduciary duty to the intending immigrant to make sure that she can immigrate and make sure that she gets the joint sponsor that she needs for her case.
So are you basically saying that if you were representing the joint sponsor, you would tell the joint sponsor not to sign, and if you're representing the sponsored immigrant, you would say something different?
They pull in diametrically different directions. I mean, the way that attorney-client relationships work, it's up to the joint sponsor, that's for sure, whether they sign it or not. But you would want to help them deeply appreciate what they're getting into when they sign that. And pushing them in that direction necessarily means that you're pushing them in a direction that's detrimental to the interests of your other client, the intending immigrant.
And would you make an exception if the joint sponsor, let's say that you're the intending immigrant is a parent and the petitioner is an adult child and there's another child who is going to be serving as a joint sponsor, would you feel comfortable representing the joint sponsor in that situation?
We have a black and white rule at the firm that we do not represent joint sponsors, period. If we're doing the main case, if we're representing the immigrant, an intending immigrant, we do not work with the joint sponsor. And let me note that relationship does not, that arrangement does not entail additional costs for the client. A lot of times I'll get pushback from attorneys who say, well, my people wouldn't be able to afford that. That's frankly a sloppy understanding of the economics of the representation, because if you're doing that work, if you're doing the main case and the joint sponsor, there's only one possibility. Either your client is paying you to do that work, or you're doing it for free, or some combination of the two. Maybe you're doing it for a reduced cost to the client. But it's a closed system, right? You're either providing that joint sponsor I-864 on some sort of pro bono basis to your client, or else they're paying you for that work, whether it's characterized as an hourly fee or rolled into the flat fee, whatever. In the real world, they're paying for that cost. And so what I'm suggesting is that at our firm, we say, well, don't pay us to do that work because we can't ethically. So just go pay some other attorney to do it instead. And that doesn't entail an extra cost to the client. It just means that I'm not getting paid to do that work. Some other colleague is.
And then like the identity of the person who pays, so a third-party payer, so let's say that the sponsored immigrant agrees to pay the other attorney who's representing the joint sponsor, is that a common scenario?
Yep, sure. And at least in Washington State, there's absolutely nothing wrong with a third-party payer as long as it's nature of your relationship to that payer is disclosed in writing in a legal services agreement. And that's how it usually works. Usually the intending immigrant or primary sponsor will pick up the bill to have the joint sponsor's affidavit prepared.
That makes sense. Because I think one of the big objections to sending someone to another attorney for a consultation is that's the reason that we even have the standard approach of dual representation in these immigration cases is that the fees can get out of hand, and especially if you're asking a joint sponsor to really step in, and you need the joint sponsor to be able to file the application, and then you're asking the joint sponsor to pay an attorney to get representation, that seems like it's not workable. But you're suggesting that it would be okay for someone else to pay the attorney who's representing the joint sponsor, and that that could be built into the fee structure, and it could still be you're still paying for the services, whether you're paying someone else or the attorney who's representing the intending immigrant.
And usually the scenario here is you've got a relocating U.S. citizen, just moved back from the Netherlands and hasn't established a long enough track record of U.S. employment to be the primary sponsor. So not necessarily somebody who's low on resources, they just can't meet the requirements for sponsorship. So they pick up the tab for the joint sponsor. Or else you have a situation where the sponsor really doesn't have any resources, in which case the joint sponsor is probably the person who's paying for the whole representation anyway.
Mm-hmm.
To highlight it, a very articulate, well-defended, contrary view to mine was published by Bruce Hake and his partner Brian Schmidt, and that's included in the show notes that JJ is uploading. And Bruce and Brian take a contrary view to mine and think that you can draft your way through representation of a joint sponsor. And they're highly respected attorneys, so go read their opinion.
And I think it's interesting, too, because the analysis is the same. It's just a different conclusion, but they still acknowledge the basic, that there is this, the competing pressures between the joint sponsor and the intending immigrant in the representation. It's just a question of what you disclose and just kind of how you do that. But I think the idea is, if you're representing the intending immigrant, you want to get the case filed there is this conflict, and it's something that has to be considered in your representation.
Greg,
and I guess one last comment. Oh,
sorry,
go ahead.
This is Annie. I'm curious as to whether you create that same ethical wall in terms of a household member sponsor, or do you feel more comfortable about representing both the principal and the household member?
No, I would feel the same about a household member. It just, the way our practice works, that that actually hasn't come up, I don't think, since July 2015.
Mm-hmm.
But I would take the same view, because the scope of the I-64A was amended in the same way to include that certification.
Yeah, that's what I thought you would say.
just one last comment before, Ellie, I think you're going to hand it off to Annie. The question, when we're asking ourselves, is it ethical to do this work for a joint sponsor? The question, of course, isn't, are we going to be disbarred or face discipline if we do this? I mean, we set higher standards, I hope, for ourselves as practitioners. And the question is, what's the highest and best possible adherence to my duties as a professional? What course of action here would best honor my duties to the client and to ensure fairness of the process? And so it's that question, not the disbarment question, but it's that question to which I believe the answer is that you do the most diligent duty to the sponsor by handing the joint sponsor off to another attorney rather than trying to be all things to all people in the case.
And Greg, just as a practical matter, do you have other attorneys that you work with on a regular basis that makes this handoff easier for the client? For the joint sponsor, not the client.
Yep, we just have our list of attorneys who've agreed to do it, for a reasonable flat rate, and we say, these are attorneys in the community, we know and trust them, go talk to one of them.
All right, and just one more question about this discussion, this aspect of the discussion. So the prepare a statement at the end, where you're marking that your representation doesn't extend beyond the preparation of the affidavit, seems sort of consistent with Model Rule 1.2C, where you're limiting the scope of representation. Could you just talk a little bit about whether that's a possibility, whether you could limit the scope of the representation? I think you've answered that already, but if you can take the position that you're just drafting the application and you're a drafter, you're not providing any other advice or something that's a little bit more limited?
I don't have legal authority on the tip of my tongue to say whether you could potentially draft your way through that. I would never want to be in that situation, though. I mean, I don't think you're doing your best for that sponsor by, neutering your representation in that way.
All right, good point. So, Annie, we're going to ask you about when the client submits the, like, let's say that you're representing the sponsor, and there you decide that there isn't a conflict, you can represent the sponsor, but you get a tax return, and it's the tax return is prepared improperly. How do you advise the client in if you're representing the individual in the immigration matter?
Yes. So as a general rule, both taxpayers who file joint tax returns are jointly and individually responsible for any tax owed, as well as any interest or penalty due on the joint return. And this is the case even if they get divorced later on. So one spouse may be held responsible for all of the tax owed, even if the other spouse earned all of the income or is the principal breadwinner. So the Internal Revenue Code, recognizes when a spouse is, basically potentially on the hook for an improperly filed tax return. And so they created this concept of the innocent or injured spouse. And you can request relief from the Internal Revenue Service, this includes a separation of liability, which is a separate allocation of the additional tax owed between you and your former spouse, or if you're legally separated from your current spouse. There also is potentially an equitable relief for the innocent or injured spouse. I think that the IRS has a pretty good web page on this concept. Interestingly, it's under their small businesses, self-employed section.
So you're saying that, but you should fix the tax return before filing and so forth.
Absolutely, yes. You should advise both parties that the return needs to be amended. And I think the most common scenario would be if, let's say, the principal spouse filed as an individual as opposed to married with the joint return.
And that would be an important thing for for the case itself too, not just for the affidavit.
Absolutely,
right.
Yeah, it would have implications, right, for the I-485 adjustment.
And then just one last topic that we're going to address really briefly is, and this is something that both of you can address. What do you do if the beneficiary, the intending immigrant, wants to get a copy of the I-864 after it's been submitted and the petitioner says no, which is kind of like a way to identify a conflict of interest. But how do you handle that as a lawyer? Do you automatically take the position that the intending immigrant is entitled to the affidavit of support? Annie, if you can just respond quickly first, that'd
sure.
be great.
Well, that goes back to what Greg was saying about ethical considerations, not just whether you're concerned about being disbarred. So, I think that you certainly should think about that as well. I think that the attorney is obligated to provide a copy of the I-864 since it was prepared for the benefit of the sponsored immigrant, and so that person is entitled to have a copy. And I would say that I normally give that sponsored immigrant a copy of the I-864 automatically. If that becomes an issue because of perhaps a breakdown in the marriage, and then there, you know, are divorce proceedings, and the petitioner sponsor does not want to, refuses to provide a copy, then as the attorney, you can also make a Freedom of Information Act request, and you know, that generally will result in your getting the copy.
And that would be probably a good item to include in your representation agreement or in your disclosures about the joint representation.
Yes, I think so.
Greg, do you have any last minute thoughts on that issue?
Yeah, I mean, so this is one of these weird issues that, you know, it's not actually quite an ethics issue. It's a law of lawyering issue. And in Washington State, and this is the majority rule in other jurisdictions, is that the file belongs to the client. Mm-hmm. And so you got to hand it over. The I-864 is submitted in support of the DS-260 or in support of the I-485. So it's basically, you know, for all purposes, an addendum to that application. And whose application? The I-864 beneficiaries. So it's part of her file, even if she wasn't the one paying for the representation. It doesn't matter. She was the client. And so you would definitely get a replevin or a malpractice suit from that attorney, from that client, if she really wanted to come after you for it. But Annie's absolutely right that it's also possible to get the I-864 through Freedom of Information Act. It's a little bit weird to me because I think that perhaps the correct view would be that the Privacy Act would require redaction of the I-864, at least the personally identifying information of the sponsor. But in practice, we do this pretty often, and we almost always get an unredacted I-864 back.
All right, well, thank you both very much. This concludes our podcast. I want to thank you for sharing your expertise. I'll now turn it over to JJ.
Thank you very much, Alan. For those of you who will be seeking CLE credit for your participation in this podcast, please make note of the following 4-digit attendance verification code. The 4-digit code is 1346. Again, the code is 1346. Please visit AILA's Web CLE Center at www.ailawebcle.org to record your CLE credit. Thank you very much to all of our speakers for sharing their knowledge and expertise, and to you for joining us today. That concludes our podcast.